This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Garrison Keillor has written a new novel, and his main character is in trouble. Born and bred in Lake Wobegon, John Tollefson has just come to a town in upstate New York to manage a public radio station at a college for academically challenged children of financially gifted parents. This middle-aged Norwegian bachelor general manager reports to a dean who is trying to change the station's format from classical music and news to all talk. And John Tollefson hates talk radio. As he sinks deeper into public radio despair, he finds himself honored with public radio's prestigious Wally Award, given for creative management. Here's Garrison reading a passage from Woebegone Boy.
The awards program began 20 minutes late, of course, and people at the head table were introduced, and some of them spoke, and the woman next to me stood up and said a few words for a long time, and then a man in a plaid jacket talked about the Wally Award for creative management. It was named for a station manager who died in 1986 and whose colleagues wanted to honor him because they felt bad about not having liked him much. I remember him. He had an ugly nose that looked like a yam stuck to his face and a laugh like a dying goose, and everybody avoided him like crazy, and now his name lives on in the form of a Lucite trophy. The speaker referred to the original Wally as an innovator who was deeply committed to radio, a description that covers many sins indeed. And then everyone looked at me and clapped, and I rose and was handed the Wally by a woman from NPR who smiled all the way up to her gums, and I took the speech out of my breast pocket and set it on the podium. I looked up and smiled a sickly grin. I read the first paragraph. There was a famous American naval captain of the War of 1812 who, when his ship went into battle, always wore a red shirt so that if he was terribly wounded, his men would not see the blood and become demoralized. And now you know why I'm wearing brown pants. There were titters in the audience, and a woman in a red suit sitting at a front table put her hand to the side of her face and rolled her eyes. Thus, I launched into the speech I hoped would win me a job at the Ford Foundation with a poop joke. Oh, boy. The speech was about how public radio, in the midst of the balkanization of broadcasting, is creating an intelligent, centrist voice, blah, blah, woof, woof. I did a page of that, and the crowd was quiet. And I wished I had told the joke about the engineer going to the guillotine. I plowed through another page, skipping over a long passage about a remote South American Aboriginal tribe that knew nothing of toothbrushes or mirrors or cameras and was given a dozen cellular phones, which it incorporated into its religion as sacred totems and instruments of prayer. I skipped that and talked about the building of WSJO. And then I saw that the rest of the speech was laced with references to that South American tribe. So I had to backtrack and sort of summarize about the cellular phone thing, which took a while. And I fumbled around, and the crowd got restless. They could sense what a flop it was. Their bloodlust was aroused. They exchanged knowing glances. This is pretty awful, isn't it? Oh, yes, this is a stinker, all right. And suddenly, I was in a gloopy passage about public radio as a telephone in a dark forest whereby the brave exchange their messages. Where did this dreck come from, I thought. And I felt thoroughly ashamed to be giving a speech this dumb and wasting everyone's time. I felt bitter shame rise in my throat. I was choking on it. I wanted to stop, if only I could find a stopping place. And then the woman with the gums passed a note over to me. Wind it up, thank you. That was pretty disconcerting. I flipped two pages and looked for the paragraph about the funding crisis in public broadcasting. It was somewhere in there. I searched. I skipped another page, and I looked up at the audience and grinned and said, almost to the end. And then there was a crash, as if someone had dropped a bowling ball. It was Bob Edwards's head. He was sitting at the main table, two seats away from the podium, and apparently he had rested his chin on his hand and closed his eyes and fallen asleep. And then his elbow slipped, and his head whacked the table. Cups and saucers bounced, and people thought, coronary. The voice of NPR's popular morning edition, dead. And then Bob Edwards raised his head and grinned, and people clapped. They practically gave him an ovation. I said, and thank you very much for this fine award, and stuffed the speech in my pocket and turned and got out of there as fast as I could. Bob Edwards reached out to shake my hand, and so did the woman from All Things Considered, but I couldn't bear to talk to anyone. I had talked enough.
That's great. That's Garrison Keillor reading from his new novel, Woebegone Boy. One of the things I find a real scream about that particular reading, I think anyone who's worked in public radio for a long time, such as myself, feels the strain of having given one metaphor too many about the mission of public radio. You're always in the position of having to justify public radio, whether it's during a fundraiser or at a speech or whatever. Your character feels this strain.
My character feels a proper sense of shame on standing up and boring people at great length.
You said in one interview that you think that there's not enough self-criticism within public radio. And I'm wondering if you think that's in part because of the pressure of fundraising. We have to kind of keep up this image that, you know, public radio is like really perfect. Everything is great. We're all deserving of praise because I think everybody's afraid that if we're imperfect and if we're not completely deserving of praise, then it would just be another excuse for people to not pledge, you know? Do you think that inhibits self-criticism?
There's a terrible lack of criticism in radio. There's every show that goes on to television, either public or commercial, is widely reviewed by people who are conversant with television and who for the most part care about it and believe in it. There is nothing of the sort in radio, either within radio or from the outside in newspapers. And this is a great lack. We suffer for this.
There's a joke that John Tollefson tells in the novel for which he is accused of being politically incorrect. So have you ever gotten accused of doing something, you know, offensive, insulting to women or to a racial or ethnic group in your show, you know, as part of your
All of
humor?
The time.
Yeah, what kind of stuff?
All of the time. At least two or three times a month, I'd say.
Give me an example.
What's memorable to me are not the sketches or the lines within a sketch that trigger people's anger, but rather the letters that they write themselves, the care that people bring to honing the angry letter into and make it as sharp and sweeping and heroic as possible. It's the great art of our time, the working oneself up into a high dudgeon. Self-righteousness is the art form of our time, and the angry letters that people write to us are so much more of a literary invention than the little joke, the tiny offhand reference that inspired them.
Do you think maybe these people are hoping you'll read the letters on the air because they're so well written? This will be their moment of glory? No.
No, but it is their moment of glory. To rise, to draw oneself up to one's full height and in great moral hauteur to look down at this pitiful, miserable, ill-educated, this crude, this tasteless person, and to bestow your hauteur upon him. It must be terribly, terribly satisfying.
What's
the pleasures of self-righteousness? I think are right up there at the top.
What's your reaction when somebody accuses you of having done something offensive on the show? Is it an occasion for deep introspection, or do you just think, oh, God, listeners are so fussy? Or does it just depend on what's being said, and you'll, depending on whether you think they're right or not, introspect or ignore it? I've given you three choices, I think.
For the most part, I think it's a fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote what I wrote, did what I did, said what I said on the air. It's done, it's said, and it's gone. Radio is self-erasing. It's hardly a permanent blight. I had the fun of doing the show, and then they have the fun of writing that letter. The letter that begins, I have been a supporter of public radio and of a Prairie Home Companion for years and years, and have been one of your most devoted listeners until last Saturday, when you, and so forth, when you said that unthinkable, that horrible thing that you said, and my face just went pale. I lost the feeling in my fingers. I turned that radio off, and the rest of that Saturday was just hollow agony for me. I could not sleep that night. I went to church on Sunday. I have been walking in a sort of a nightmare of disbelief ever since. I may have to take disability at work. Your casual line has turned my life around, and I now appeal to you, sir. That sort of letter, I think, is enormously satisfying. And I sort of enjoy reading them, too. I mean, some are better than others.
Do you respond to them?
I do sometimes. Usually I have somebody who's nicer than I respond to them. We have some very nice people who work on our show, and they write wonderful, mollifying letters.
Letters like the one you just described often end with, "and therefore,
and
after
therefore,
pledging for many years, I will never send any
never
money
again.
Ever again to public
ever.
Radio. So how does it make you feel? I mean,
well, I feel bad. I mean, I'm not in the business of trying to provoke people. God knows, I'm in the business of amusing people and making them helpless with merriment, and laugh convulsively until food comes out of their noses is my line of work. And so if you infuriate somebody, you know it's not what you're here for, and I feel bad about it. But on the other hand, the things that trigger these letters are usually pretty slight.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get letters about this.
Well, have your staff answer them. They seem to know what they're doing.
Yes.
My guest is Garrison Keillor. His new novel is called Woebegone Boy. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Garrison Keillor, and his new novel is called Woebegone Boy. There's a radio show that your character listens to that's one of these kind of, old-fashioned shows called The Top of the Morning Show with Ole and Toivo. What is that show like, the way you've imagined it?
It's two men talking in Scandinavian accents and telling ancient jokes about Swedes and Norwegians. And doing commercials for linoleum and indoor-outdoor carpeting and plywood, and giving you the weather forecast.
Yeah, yeah.
The weather is what you've tuned these guys in for. This is Minnesota. The show is broadcast in Lake Wobegon, and this is the favorite show of John Tollefson's father, Byron. You get the livestock report, and if you should lose your dog in Lake Wobegon, you probably would not call up Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul and ask them if they would broadcast this as a part of All Things Considered, but you would call up the Ole and Toivo show, and they'd say, heck, sure. What does that dog look like anyway? Where did you last see her?
What were the kind of radio shows that made the biggest impression when you were young?
I loved scary shows on the radio, and scary shows, of course, depended on sound effects men. They surely didn't depend on the writers. There wasn't that much dialogue.
Uh-huh.
But you heard the monster coming up the walk, and you heard the gravel crunch under the monster's feet, and you could hear the monster breathe. And the monster was at the door, and then all of a sudden the monster was right there with you. And this made a profound impression on a child, especially since these shows came on after dark. I have never been scared in the movies or by television. Television's not scary at all. As I was scared by radio.
I bet that's obviously part of the reason why you like having, you know, elaborate sound effects in your sketches on your show.
We did a comedy sketch once about a doctor. Actually, it was a sketch about a sketch. I was talking about listening to something on the radio in which the reporter was talking about a new surgical device for operating on your eye. And our sound effects man, Tom Keith, made a few little sounds with some metal utensils. And although the audience in the Fitzgerald Theater could see that we were kidding, they started to get uneasy. And then he started talking as the doctor. Easy now, I'm just going to put this over your eye now. Okay, and it's just going to go over your eye like this. And this won't hurt, but don't blink now, okay? Don't blink. Okay, you all ready? You ready now? And people could hardly bear it. I saw people get up and leave. Hmm. They were ill at the thought of somebody placing this little frame with a knife in it over their open eyeball.
I think it's a high... It's a high compliment.
Terry, are you still
when,
there?
Yeah, it's a high compliment when people get up and leave, don't you think?
Well, it wasn't the compliment
them.
I was looking for at that point, but it was a testimonial to the power of radio.
Well, Garrison Keillor, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. You take care.
Garrison Keillor's new novel is called Woebegone Boy. It will be published next week. This is Fresh Air.